An expedition team is almost in Nome. Two others drop out. Jesse wins another award, and we have a race to the coast. Let's kick it off.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with the history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Today's audio file comes from a good friend of ours and the co-host with Robert on our Dog Driver Show, a podcast that interviews sprint dog mushers from all over the world. Karoche Partout, or KP to his friends. He chose White Horse by Chris Stapleton. And here are the lyrics. Someday, maybe you could have your way. Right now, just not the time. Something a man just got to do. I wish you could change my mind. Oh, oh, oh. If you want a cowboy on a white horse, riding off into the sunset.
I know you like Chris Stapleton, but he is definitely not my jam. And I know that it is a love song, but the lyrics fit into dog mushing, right?
Sure they do.
What do you guys think? Let us know in the comments.
And Robert, I really do enjoy Chris Stapleton.
All right, guys, welcome to the Burled Arch Podcast. I'm Robert, and I'm here with my co-host, Michelle, and we have a lot to talk about as things develop in Iditarod. Typically, it happens in the middle of the night, right? As I mentioned in the cold open, we have an expedition musher making his way to Nome. We have one that dropped out, and another one that is way back in McGrath who decided to call it quits. But before we jump into all that, we have one heck of a race. We're recording this at 7 p.m. Alaska time on Sunday the 15th. Jesse Holmes is at mile 36 with 239 miles to go. Travis Beals is literally on his heels, only 3 miles behind with 242 miles to go. And Paige Drobny is about 18 miles from the front runner there with 253 miles to go. In fourth, Millie Porcelet at 714, 261 to go. And Riley Dyke, 714 with 261 to go. In the back of the pack, we have Jody Potts Joseph at mile 562 with 413 to go. Grayson Burton, 563 with 412 to go. Adam Lindermuth at 578 and 397 to go. And Sam Papperman at 582 and 393 miles to go. Before we talk about the news of the day, Jesse Holmes claims another award. As we know, he is the defending Iditarod champion and putting on one heck of a race. He pulled into Unicolete on Sunday at 9:27 a.m. with 13 dogs in harness, and he won the Ryanair Gold Coast Award that consists of $2,500 of gold nuggets. Remember, he claimed $3,000 in gold nuggets a while back from the Bering Sea region, a carved loon made by Arctic Mark Tepton, and gold pen plaque commemorating his accomplishments. So definitely collecting all of those awards. Luckily, he does not have to put all those in his sled. He will get those at the finisher's banquet next Sunday. Michelle?
I did notice that it appears that everyone has taken their 8-hour rest. So that means that everyone has done all of their mandatories with the exception of the 8-hour rest in White Mountain.
Yes, they do have to take an 8-hour rest on the Yukon. We do have several mushers scattered about, and then there is that final rest there at the White Mountain checkpoint, and then it's 77 miles to go past that. There is another checkpoint in safety that's about 22 miles, but unless it's a major storm, and we're going to talk about that on one of these days this week, not a lot of people stop there. So what is the big news of the day? First off, it was announced this afternoon that Thomas Verner, the Iditarod champion in 2020, who was one of the support folks for Shell Roki, he was on a dog team, and in Unicleet, he said, "That's it, I've had enough, my dog team has kennel cough, I am going to pull out." Roki continued on down the trail with his support crew, and he is looking to come into Nome in just a little bit. And we got a media briefing from Iditarod on how to talk about that. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. But first, we're going to talk about Steve Curtis. For the last few days, everybody in Iditarod Nation was trying to figure out what in the world is going on with Steve Curtis way back there in McGrath. Remember last night, he was over 400 miles of trail from the front of the pack to where he sat. Well, it was announced earlier this morning that his race was done in McGrath, and it's my understanding that they held it pretty close to the cuff, but that was the intention all along, for him to do 300 miles and then call it a day. I understand that there is an interview or a soundbite or something out there where he said, Steve Curtis said, it's going to be a fun, quote, 3 days. So he is done. And interestingly enough, as I was driving into Wasilla early afternoon, as I was passing through Houston, Alaska, which is about halfway from Willow to Wasilla, what passed me on the left? A Husky Homestead trailer. So it looks like the news is true. They are heading north. And Jeff King's crew, I guess, is off the trail and on their way home. So I know that there's been a lot of chat about what's going on with Mr. Roki. And I know you want to mention something there, Michelle, but I do want to talk about what Iditarod put out just about 2 hours ago. And remember, we're one of the credentialed media folks here at Mushing Magazine, and they said, say something similar to, we are approaching an historic event on the trail. Our inaugural expedition musher, Mr. Roki, is nearing the ceremonial finish line in Nome. Remember that the expedition class is a non-competitive designation. They are completing the trail alongside the 2026 race, but they are not competing for official standings or awards. So before we talk about controlling the narrative a little bit, Michelle, I know you've searched high and low on the interwebs on this and read all through all the pages and all that. What are folks saying?
Well, Robert, when I had time in between dog training classes today, I did see a little bit of the goings on. Now, I did miss what was said about Curtis, so I'll catch you guys up on what I saw for Roki. And a lot of you probably have already seen the same chatter I was seeing, in that it seems to be still a little bit confusing about the dynamics that were set forth for Verner and Roki and Steve Curtis. Now, I did do an interview with Jeff King, and he, remember, told me that they were running Jessica Klyka's dogs, and that he and Jessica were Curtis's support team. He did not allude to me whatsoever about this 3 days or 300 miles and stopping in McGrath. So that was a surprise to me, just as much as it was to you. However, the chatter this afternoon that I saw regarding Verner and Roki was a little bit more involved, meaning that the chatter is saying that Werner's dogs are sick, and that means Roki's dogs are sick and he should pull out, and that Werner was Roki's support team, and why is he getting to go on without a support team? Now, I know from my interview with Roki, even though we didn't include this portion, Roki has his own support staff, not just Werner, but Yor Olsom is his snow machiner alongside Yor's wife, who is a veterinarian. So he has a full staff as well.
And just to add a little bit to that, Yor Olsom is also a pilot, so I'm sure there are plenty of connections out there for the chatter that's going on about flying dogs in and out and all of that.
Absolutely. And you know what? I think that once Shell Roki comes into Nome and goes under the Burled Arch, he will have quite the story to tell. And I think that that's part of the reason why he's doing this. At least that's what he told me off air, is that he really wanted to see all of Alaska. He has a great admiration for all of the dog mushers that are participating in the race today, as well as from years past. Remember, you guys, he has been part of Alaska for a long time through fishing.
So I know that there is a lot of hubbub around this topic, and we've tried our best to keep it civil as best as we can. And as you know, everybody has opinions, especially on today's social media world. But if you followed Iditarod for any amount of time, you know that they control the narrative to their event, which is their prerogative. Any event that is held is allowed to decide on what is said, what is done, who can enter, who can withdraw, all of those things. It is very similar to triathlons, 5Ks, even the NFL and other pro sports. And as you know, Rod Urbach, the executive from Iditarod, comes from the triathlon world. So I looked it up to see how we can compare a triathlon or race similar and how it is broadcasted over media. Organizers can absolutely hold a private event where they control the narrative, restrict media access, and own the rights to all images and videos produced. That is directly from the Ironman website. Of course, with that, private ownership of the event is necessary. Organizers often structure the race as private events, even if they take place on public roads or trails. By doing so, they control who enter, who can film, and how the event is portrayed. Again, from Iditarod and try247.com. Media rights and control. Organizers can prohibit any third-party filming, live streaming, or broadcasting without written permission. They also have final cut approval. Organizers such as Ironman often require final approval on any documentary or broadcasting or film produced by them, and that comes from USA Track. Restrictions on participants. This is the big one. Social media, cameras, etc. In recent years, organizers have tightened restrictions on participants themselves, aiming to ensure that official media partners have exclusive coverage. That is from the Marathon Handbook. On-course filming. Some large organizations have updated the rules to ban on-course photography or videography by athletes, including GoPro cameras, to prevent unauthorized content creation. And just as a side, Triathlon just banned those metacamera glasses that are becoming very popular. Contractual control, another big one. In professional triathlons, organizers often mandate that athletes allow them to own all content produced during the race to ensure a real narrative. That also comes from try247.com. And the last thing I want to mention, public versus private events. While major races often work with the media for publicity, they are not obligated to do so. If the event is on private property, the organizers have total authority to ban recording. If it's on public property, they still have a large amount of control through permits and contractual agreements with participants regarding the use of field of play material, USA Track. In summary, organizers can and frequently do tightly control the narrative, often restricting on-course cameras and demanding that all broadcasts or shared content be authorized by them. Again, from USA Track and Ironman. So what does all this have to do with Iditarod? First off, they do not have to cater to the fans. They are doing so in order to promote their event. This is a private event. You pay to enter. They can decide who runs. They can decide their rules. There was even a ruling back in 2009, I believe it was, where a musher sued the Iditarod for being withdrawn, and the judge pretty much says, you know what? You guys made your rules, but you don't need to follow them. That was held in Alaska District Court. So what does all this mean, Michelle? What are you thinking?
Well, basically, it means exactly what you said. You're paying to participate. And when you're paying to participate in any event, that event has the right to control the narrative. If you are a fan and you are on Insider, you are still paying for that access. You're paying for the participation. They are giving you more of the narrative by subscribing to Insider than if you are not subscribing to Insider. And while you're out there chomping at the bit, following your favorite musher on their page, on their social media, they are too restricted to what they are allowed to post live. That is a lot of the reason why many of the posts come a few hours after, because especially now with the Snow Machine crew out there providing additional commentary and film and photographs, they want the opportunity to post first so that their insiders that are paying for the information get that behind the scenes stuff. Am I right?
Yeah. The point I'm trying to talk about is obviously we have passionate fans, whether we're following Iditarod or Ironman or your favorite football.
Even NASCAR.
Your favorite football team, NASCAR, whatever. Fans are very demanding, especially on social media today. We've always said that in Iditarod, social media was a blessing and a curse. And I say this because I am a passionate follower of a bunch of sports, not just Iditarod. We have season tickets to the Seattle Kraken, the NHL team, that we go down quite often. We're members of all those groups. And if you go in any of those groups, the comments back and forth are often very much the same. They often say something like, the organization should not be allowed to do this, or they are not taking their fans into account, or they shouldn't have made that trade, or whatever. It's just common fandom chatter. But when we look at Iditarod, you often see on this topic specifically that, quote, they've ruined the essence of the race, or they shouldn't be allowed to be out front, or we are demanding more transparency, or all of those things. There's nothing wrong with any of those comments, and that's what brings commentary. That's what brings podcasts and social media posts and news articles and all of those things. But they can do what they want. It is a private event. And I'm sure people are probably screaming at their earphones right now as we talk about this, but we stand fully on this. No, we have never competed in Iditarod, but just like any other media outlet out there, we're allowed to say our opinion and give our thoughts and hopefully try to heighten the narrative. Michelle, one last point on this before we move on.
I absolutely agree. You know, it's always hard to armchair quarterback or, you know, mush from your couch. I love that guy's Facebook page. The best thing I can tell you is sit back, relax, and try to enjoy the statistics, because literally, Iditarod is a race surrounded about strategic statistical events. Because just because right now Paige and Jesse were leading the pack virtually side by side from day one, here comes that dark horse.
Travis Beals.
Mr. Travis Beals. It's going to be a race to the finish.
And if I remember correctly, I think he was my dark horse in my predictions, if I recall.
I'd have to go find my notebook where I wrote that down. So, yeah, it doesn't matter. I think it's gonna make things interesting. And, you know, there's quite a few things behind Mr. Holmes. And there's a lot of land between where he is and Nome still.
So I guess to summarize, the Expedition class has generated a heck of a lot more eyeballs and fans. That's what their intention was. I see on countless pages now jumping on the Iditarod bandwagon. I'm sure most of those are click farms. If you're not familiar with what a click farm is, it is when somebody posts a page. Typically, it's a picture that says, please like this picture and become a fan of our page or whatever. And it'll be some sad sob story. And then after they collect all those clicks and likes and all that, they will quickly switch focus of the page. And you're seeing this countless times with stories about Iditarod. I have never...
It's a definite PETA tactic.
I have never seen so many articles written about the Iditarod this year. I mean, we have pages by famous people and distilleries and musical acts, and the whole nine yards are all jumping on the Iditarod bandwagon. I don't know if that is the expedition class. Actually, I know it's not, because most of those people have no idea what an expedition class is, but it's definitely bringing more eyeballs. Now, whether those eyeballs are real or it is a click farm or clickbait or whatever it is, it's interesting to bring that up. And I say all that because you should definitely trust your sources on the pages that you follow. They make it real easy to figure out the scam pages for Iditarod. There are thousands of those out there that say, oh, we're Iditarod, buy our shirts or sign up for our insider or whatever. And often those are scam or bot pages. We're not talking about those. We're talking about these click farms that are looking for clicks on just the basic stories. Almost always those stories are written by AI. Almost always they're using the same photos over and over again. I saw one today that was talking about a bison encounter, and it was about one of the male mushers. I can't recall which one it was, and it had a very blurry picture of the attack. And guess who that attack picture was of? Jody Potts Joseph, talking about a male musher encountering a bison. So there you have it, guys. Lots more eyeballs, but definitely not the best coverage. Michelle, let's jump over to something a little bit lighter. We're going to talk about musher profile of the evening. It is the defending champ and poised for a twofer, Jesse Holmes.
That's right. Tonight's musher profile feature is Jesse Holmes. He is one of the most recognizable figures in modern long-distance mushing and the defending champion of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Jesse grew up far from Alaska in Alabama, but even as a kid, he dreamed about living a life close to the land. Much of that inspiration came from his grandfather, an outdoorsman who introduced him to hunting, dogs, and self-reliance. That early influence stuck. At 18 years old, Jesse left home in search of adventure and eventually made his way north. By 2004, he had settled in Alaska, where he found the wilderness lifestyle he had been chasing. Holmes' early years in Alaska were not centered on racing at all. He began running sled dogs on a remote trap line along the Yukon River, using his team the way dog teams had been used for generations. The dogs hauled wood, helped with trapping and hunting, and served as transportation across miles of winter trail. That working partnership with the dogs shaped the foundation of his kennel and his approach to the sport. Eventually, that practical trail experience led him into competitive racing. Holmes entered the Iditarod for the first time in 2018 and immediately made an impression, finishing seventh and earning Rookie of the Year honors. From there, he steadily climbed the ranks of long-distance mushing, becoming one of the most consistent competitors on the circuit. Over the years, his racing resume has grown to include victories in races like the Kobuk 440, a win in the Yukon Quest Alaska 300, and multiple top five finishes in the Iditarod between 2022 and 2025. Those performances ultimately led to the biggest milestone of his career when he captured the Iditarod Championship in 2025. He has also remained competitive in other major mid-distance events, including strong performances at races like the Copper Basin 300. Today, Holmes lives and trains along the Denali Highway near Brushkana River, where he has built a homestead from the ground up. The area is considered some of the best training in Alaska, with wide open trails and long stretches of wilderness that allow teams to develop the endurance required for 1,000-mile races. When he's not racing, Holmes embraces the same subsistence lifestyle that first drew him to Alaska. He spends his time running long distances, hunting, trapping, fishing, and working on his off-grid homestead. Many people outside the mushing world also recognize him from the television series Life Below Zero, which documents the realities of living in remote Alaska. Despite the growing recognition, Holmes often says the heart of what he does hasn't changed. It is still about the dogs, the trail, and the lifestyle that connects them. As the defending Iditarod champion returns to the runners, he is once again traveling across Alaska's vast landscape with the same goal he had when he first arrived in the north, living with life close to the land with a team of dogs leading the way. One nugget, if you guys recall from my soundbite with Jody. Jody has a dog named Stormy. She absolutely loves this dog. He has a connection to Jesse, and so does Jody. And isn't that ironic that Jesse is leading the trail and Jody is bringing up the rear?
I met Jesse many years ago sitting around a bonfire in Tok with Iditarod and Yukon Quest champion Hugh Neff. We chatted about dogs, and this was long before his days on Life Below Zero, where he became a household name outside of dog mushing. My fondest memory, Michelle was part of this, was a pub crawl by horse-drawn carriage hayride that we did with Jesse and a bunch of other conference attendees at an ISDRA conference way up in northern Wisconsin several years ago. I remember we pulled into one of those pubs and Jesse and I and Michelle, we had a very quick fish fry dinner. It was Friday in Wisconsin. And we talked about stuff. We didn't talk about Iditarod. We didn't talk about, you know, fandom and all that. We just chatted.
We did talk about home.
We talked about home a little bit, yes.
We were the three fish out of water at this International Sprint Sled Dog Racing Association conference. Jesse was the keynote speaker, and Robert and I were there emceeing, and it was a lot of fun. But man, were we the three fish out of water.
I will never forget how many times we stopped at those pubs along the way. I can't recall how many beers we had, but thankfully they were driving us all over the countryside in that hayride.
It was eight or nine of them, and there is a reason why you don't remember.
Yeah. So I also met up with Jesse again this past October at the IFSS Dryland World Championships, also held in Wisconsin. He was the keynote speaker there, and we spoke briefly before he went on stage, and we just talked again about stuff. We didn't talk about fandom and everything else. So it's a lot of fun to hang out with these guys sometimes. This definitely isn't a name drop. It's more of our way to show a different side of these guys other than everything about Iditarod. These guys do enough out on the trail, but hey, they're allowed to have lives as well, and I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir. So up next is our mushing moment in history.
Welcome to the Mushing Podcast. It's time for another memorable moment in mushing history, sponsored by Peak Experience, providing experiential and team-building courses.
Let's step back in time to March 1978, further back along the trail. Andrew Foxy of Stebbins was the last musher through the Alaska Range. Concerned for his safety, Iditarod Committee Chairman Bill Devine went to look for him. He found Foxy hunting ptarmigan in the pass. Once underway, Foxy made speedy time to the next checkpoint. Foxy may have been carrying the lantern for a short while, but he quickly passed five teams and is expected into Farewell tomorrow morning. Not yet into Farewell and reported behind Foxy are Roger Roberts of Tocotna, Gary Campen of Caltag, Shelley Vandiver of Anchorage, Bill Rose of Palmer, and Colonel Norman Vaughn. All other teams are at Farewell, McGrath, or in between. 39 teams are still on the trail. No scratches so far. And of an interesting note, since we cover the race 48 years later as a podcast that is listened to by fans all over the world, there is a lack of color information this year. All news media are having trouble. Hopefully, things will pick up as the teams approach Nome. Interest by the media is higher than ever. Mutual Radio told us they want feeds. CBS is reportedly interested. It is likely that KNOM will feed the race finish live to KYAK Anchorage and KIAK Fairbanks and to the 82 stations of the Alaskan Forces Radio Network. There is no word on which newspapers are following the race. Last year, the London Daily Mail had a full-time reporter on the trail. Bill Devine is accompanying a German film crew who are assembling a one-hour television documentary on the race for German TV. Late word, the Los Angeles Times is sending up a reporter. That is pretty cool.
So even almost 50 years later, they are still doing the same things on the trail. Pretty cool to hear that from Team and Trail 1978.
Yeah, and Robert, I found it really interesting. Did you guys hear what I said at the beginning? Foxy was found hunting ptarmigan in the pass. And then all of a sudden, he makes a mad dash and passes a whole bunch of people. I'm just wondering how often mushers today take time to go hunting for ptarmigan.
Never. Obviously never. There was even a new rule.
It's so romantic.
Yes, there's even a new rule. If there is a game that is slaughtered, I guess, out on the trail, they must dress them out on the trail before they continue. If you remember a couple of years ago with Dallas Seavey and his encounter with the moose and all of that. And I remember in our series that we're doing with Rod Perry right here on our feed, we're dropping episode 3 today. He talks about a little bit of this, the folks going out hunting for ptarmigan and all of that. Of course, back in the day, it was much more of a camping trip than
it is today. I think
it
was much more of, dare I say it, an expedition.
Or an adventure, for sure. So very cool stuff. I like how all the media are coming together, including the London Daily Mail. I doubt we have a London Daily Mail reporter out there. We may have somebody that's on the interwebs from the Los Angeles Times, so on and so forth, but very cool. But let's very quickly talk about the Caltag Portage, Old Woman Cabin, and the history of the Serum Run. So as you guys know, after the teams get off of the Yukon, they hang a hard right, I guess it is, by the map, and they go about 90 miles up through a portage from the Yukon to the coast. This is one of the most treacherous areas of the trail just because it's literally in the middle of nowhere. About halfway through there is Old Woman Cabin. And if you're a long-term Iditarod fan, you know the superstitions behind Old Woman Cabin. It's often a place where teams are stopping to do a quick camping trip or to get out of the wind or the weather or whatever. But the superstition has it that you must leave candy for the old woman. And if you don't, you may be stricken on the trail. So often, people won't even stop. They'll just grab a handful of candy that they've been carrying in one of their drop bags, and they'll throw out Halloween-type candy to the old woman along the way. It's very interesting. I'm always looking forward to stopping at the Old Woman Cabin by dog team. I cannot wait to do that, and I cannot wait to have one of those Takotna pies and a pizza from Peace on Earth by Dog Team. We're going to release a little bit more information about that as soon as our coverage is over next Sunday. Very quickly about the history of the Serum Run. We mentioned in our moment in history that there was a guy by the name of Norman Vaughn. Iditarod fans know all about this guy. He was the prototypical adventurer, expeditioner. He did Iditarod a few times. I believe he was one of the oldest people to ever finish the Iditarod. Maybe Jim Lanier was older. I'm not sure. I'll have to check my facts there, or somebody can do that on socials. But anyway, after he was done, they started up the Serum Run 25 Norman Vaughn Expedition. And it was kind of a commemorative run from Nenana to Nome. They ran it every couple of years. On even years, I believe, and they would do the whole thing. They would stop in the villages, they would do talks, they would do all of that. And when I first started mushing dogs up in Alaska, I worked very briefly for a Serum Run kennel and helped them plan for it and got them all prepped up, and we did a shakedown and all that. And then 2020, we also attempted to do our own Serum Run expedition. Sadly, I had to pull out. That is a story for another day, but it is something that is very close to us and something that we follow pretty closely. That official Serum Run nonprofit stopped in, I believe, about 2012-ish, and there's been a lot of expeditions afterwards, including our co-host that we had for a couple of times thus far, Jonathan Hayes, who did the expedition last year as the Centennial Sepala expedition that he was paying homage to the Sepala Siberians from Leonard Sepala. He has his dogs go back that far, and there's been countless others. So when we chatter about expedition teams on the trail, this is something that's been going on for a long time. It's not something new. The only thing different now, is they have the logistics of the Iditarod. Michelle, what is next on the podcast or anything else before we go?
Well, tomorrow we're going to talk about the race to Nome. Maybe give you guys a little bit of history about Nome, a refresher about the Burled Arch. And if you've got questions, be sure to leave us a text or a voicemail by calling our hotline at 303-578-9881, or you can leave us an email at podcast@mushing.com.
And as every good podcaster does, we always say the same thing at the end of every episode on any podcast anywhere in the world. Do not forget to subscribe, follow, push that plus sign, whatever it is, on the podcast player that you're listening on. That way you will never miss an episode. So just do that if you are a fan of us. If you love our coverage, please leave us a review, even a bad one. We're prone to mistakes. You can do that on any podcast player as well. That really helps us out on searchability as well as ranking. And speaking of rankings, very cool fact, we are one of the top three podcasts in the world, according to Listen Notes, which is an aggregate podcast player. episode generator, and we are ranked in the top three in the world. That's pretty dang cool up against some of the big boys like Joe Rogan and ESPN and all of those others. So something cool to hang our hat on, and we would not be here unless
just it was... Just a couple of willow billies sitting in their cabin with a fire going and a rinky-dink podcast studio.
I don't know about rinky-dink.
And we're in the top three.
I don't know about rinky-dink, but we only get this way because we shoot it straight. We're not a bunch of fluff. We talk about things that other people don't like to talk about, including that private event thing that we talked about earlier in the episode. So with that, we will see you guys tomorrow. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.